Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is domestic terrorism. With me to discuss the changing landscape of domestic terror groups is Bruce Hoffman. Bruce is the Shelby Cullum and Catherine W. Davis Senior Fellow for Counterterrorism and Homeland Security at CFR. He is also a professor at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, where for many years he directed the Center for Security Studies, as well as the Security Studies Program. Bruce is a visiting professor of terrorism studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland as well. His most recent book is Inside Terrorism. Bruce, thanks for being here.
I'm delighted.
I hope all is well with you in these unusual times.
As well as can be.
Okay, well, let's get right to the topic. You and I have been corresponding via email in the wake of the protests that have broken across the country after the killing of George Floyd, because there have been a number of allegations that when these largely peaceful protests have turned violent, it has been the result of organized agitators. And I will note that a lot of the criticism coming from the Trump administration has blamed a group known as Antifa for the violence. I know FBI Director Christopher Wray said, let me quote him here, the violence is a result of anarchists like Antifa and other agitators. Attorney General Barr has claimed evidence that Antifa and other similar extremist groups have been responsible for the violence. I'll note that President Trump tweeted saying that the 75-year-old protester with the head wound in Buffalo could be an Antifa provocateur. What I would like to do is sort of examine these charges. But first, perhaps you could tell us, Bruce, what is Antifa?
Antifa stands basically for anti-fascism, and it is a movement that consciously emulates the anti-fascist groups that fought street battles in Weimar Germany before Hitler's rise to power, in Italy after Mussolini and the fascists took over, and then resurfaced in Europe in the 1960s. It first came to the United States a decade or a bit more later, certainly by the 1980s, and it was then called Anti-Racist Action. It was a group of individuals that would go out and confront neo-Nazis, skinheads, Ku Klux Klan, and others in violent confrontations. I mean, street brawls, in essence, or demonstrations on both sides that on occasion degenerated into riots. Where Antifa really became known in the United States was in the events surrounding President Trump's inauguration in January 2017, when there were instances of vandalism, a smashing of plate glass windows in downtown Washington, D.C. Some cars and SUVs were set afire. The then spokesman of the alt-right, Richard Spencer, was punched in the face by someone claiming to be from Antifa. And that was where they really surfaced. Again, during the summer of 2017, which was a very tense summer, there were demonstrations, of course, by neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, and also another demonstration in Berkeley, both of which degenerated into some brawling and street fighting. And of course, in Charlottesville, a neo-Nazi killed a demonstrator, Heather Heyer, there. She did not have anything to do with Antifa, but Antifa's name became associated with those incidents. But it's a misnomer, I think, to call it a terrorist group or organization, because it isn't an organization. It isn't a group.
Well, what's the difference, Bruce, between a movement and an organization?
Well, an organization, at least as we've traditionally looked at terrorist ones, has some command and control, an identified leader, some means of communication, planning and plotting of attacks. Antifa is a much more amorphous, malleable type of entity. It communicates with one another. There's no headquarters to identify. There's no leaders to arrest or take down. There's no financial flows that we can interdict. I mean, all the tools that we've used so successfully against groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS and recent years don't apply to something that is not really at all hierarchical and is very loosely and flexibly organized in a quite linear fashion.
Does Antifa have a website, a newspaper, a podcast, a TV show? I mean, I'm trying to understand how this group works to the extent it's a group as opposed to a movement in terms of contacting with one another to show up and to meet the neo-Nazis and the right-wing groups.
It's the archetypal grassroots organization. It communicates on computer bulletin boards, on chat rooms, on encrypted apps, for example. It exchanges information on when demonstrations or protests will be, especially when neo-Nazis or white supremacists or extremists of the far right are going to organize to confront them. There has been one significant terrorist incident connected to Antifa where somewhat elderly individual named Willem van Spraan in Tacoma, Washington, in July 2018, attacked an ICE, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility, attempt to firebomb it. He himself was killed in the operation. That's the only clear terrorist incident in any way connected with them. But certainly acts of vandalism, acts of arson, street fighting is much more their modus operandi.
Now, does Antifa wear a particular uniform, type of clothing to signal who they are? I mean, if you were to go to a protest, whether here in D.C. or in Atlanta or anywhere else, is there some sort of thing that says, oh, that person is with Antifa?
Not necessarily or specifically Antifa. There are individuals, and some I know from eyewitnesses, were seen in Washington, D.C. around Lafayette Park a couple of weeks ago during those events, that style themselves as the Black Bloc. And that is, they dress completely in black. They wear black balaclavas to conceal their facial features. They will not carry identification. So if they're arrested, it's very difficult to identify them. And they're the ones that are kind of the point of the spear, the action-oriented ones. Whether one can say that they're Antifa or not, it's, I think, very difficult to determine. Anarchists or anarchism becomes a catch-all phrase that knits these people together. But again, the idea that there's any kind of central command or any kind of orchestrated instructions, I think has been very difficult to ascertain, if not impossible, because it may not exist.
Let's talk about the role of Antifa, if there was a role, in the violence we've seen at some of the protests around the country. Obviously, as I mentioned a moment ago, senior administration officials have made those allegations. I will also note that at least early on in Minneapolis, in St. Paul, city officials were talking about how much of the violence and the people who've been arrested had come from other areas and had come in to be agitators. Now that we're sort of a little bit removed from that, do we have a sense of the degree to which Antifa was involved in the protests we've been seeing in the United States?
No, not really. The FBI's Washington field office has said that they haven't yet brought into custody, at least to my knowledge from the last time they issued a statement a few weeks ago, anyone who they could definitively identify as a member of Antifa. At many of these protests, the individuals being arrested, the vast majority of them have been in-state or local. In other words, it's not individuals crossing state lines to agitate or to engage in rioting, which is a federal offense. There's been a very small percentage of out-of-state people. But again, from the open source news reports, I haven't seen anything that puts a label of Antifa on them.
Now, I'll just note that one thing I was reading recently suggests that the vast majority of people who have been arrested in protests around the country have been arrested for relatively minor infractions like violating curfews, obstructing roadways, carrying an open container when they're not supposed to, as opposed to engaging in violent activities. What about another argument I've heard, which is that while Antifa affiliated individuals may not have been active in many of these protests, right-wing groups have been involved or have been posing as Antifa sympathizers in order to encourage violence. Any sort of sense about that, Bruce?
Well, I think the most serious incident of violence, fortunately, which was averted, but which arrests were made for, involved three individuals who were arrested in Las Vegas at the beginning of June. They were plotting to stage Molotov cocktail attacks at a Black Lives Matter protest as almost a false flag type of operation, or almost to encourage greater violence and greater disorder. And these three people were arrested. They have been charged. They're under indictment. Two of the three were part of this Facebook community that Facebook has actually since taken down, but it was a Facebook community advocating what is known as the Boogaloo, which is code for violent far-right extremists, for the Second Civil War, or of engendering profound disorder and anarchy in the United States so that they can emerge to take over from it. In the run-up to the Black Lives Matter protests, after George Floyd was killed. Specifically around the COVID-19 pandemic, there were some 125 different Facebook groups, 60% of which appeared from February, that were encouraging their followers to liberate state capitals, much as the president called for, sometimes not necessarily to use violence, but to bring weapons, certainly. And we saw some of this in Michigan, of course, Michigan.
In Lansing.
State legislature, precisely, did not meet because of individuals answering this call who showed up with assault weapons and combat fatigues and bulletproof vests and so on. So as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was already momentum for individuals to engage and promote an anarchy. And then the killing of George Floyd and the widespread protests we've seen across the United States was very widely seized upon and encouraged over a variety of social media for these individuals to also join in. In many cases, they wore Hawaiian shirts because Boogaloo has now become a phrase that has attracted the attention of law enforcement and the authorities. They use all sorts of code words like Big Igloo or Big Luau.
Okay, I'm going to slow you down there. You're going to have to explain to me, first off, why Hawaiian shirts and where does Boogaloo come from? Then we'll get to the Big Igloo or whatever the other phrases were you used.
Well, Boogaloo has just become a catchphrase, almost code, for communicating on social media in particular, for sparking a second civil war or creating the widespread anarchy and disorder that its adherents believe will overthrow the current United States government and replace it with a more authoritarian regime. I suppose in the strange times that we live in, the extreme far left and the extreme far right have almost come together, that they both see this as a purpose. You have extreme libertarians and extreme anarchists who both are talking about taking down the system and attempting to rally individuals to engage in acts of disorder that will facilitate that. Boogaloo refers to some songs, to a movie and a video game from some years ago that the adherents to it have either seen or listened to or played with. And then because Boogaloo has become now more known as not just this secret clandestine code word, I mean, NPR did a story about it, in fact, in early January, that this is becoming code for a new civil war. They've adopted other names so that they can remain on social media. So one of them is Big Luau, which sounds kind of like Boogaloo. And when you see people wearing Hawaiian shirts at protests, they are at least, it may be a sartorial choice, but it also could be a political affinity or an ideological affinity. And then as Big Luau became more common, as we saw photographs in newspapers, for instance, of individuals with masks but wearing Hawaiian shirts to protest, they began to use other memes such as Big Igloo, which sounds sort of similar. And this is all to defeat or defy attempts by social media to either censor them or remove them from their sites or to frustrate law enforcement attempts to track them.
Now, Bruce, when we talk about Boogaloo or Big Igloo or Big Luau or whatever the term is at the current moment, are we talking about an organization or is this similar to Antifa? Are we really talking about a movement, something more amorphous, no return address?
Exactly right. We're talking about something just like Antifa when we say Boogaloo, something without a hierarchy or a leadership, without a command and control, without orders. We're talking about a phrase that in many cases unites fairly disparate viewpoints. Persons zealously committed to Second Amendment rights, for example, people who are opposed to taxes, people who are opposed to government interference in terms of ordering us to wear face masks, for example, arch libertarians. Also, there is some crossover with white supremacists and white nationalists, with neo-Nazis and with others who are attempting to harness some of these anti-government sentiments for their own purposes. But yes, exactly right. I mean, Boogaloo and Antifa were both talking about completely amorphous, non-organizational entities.
Tell me a little bit more about the ties between this sort of amorphous Boogaloo movement and existing organizations. I mean, there is a real neo-Nazi organization in this country that puts together events, if you can call them that, has leaders. You mentioned Richard Spencer before, part of the white supremacist movement. So what are these connections?
It's interesting. You know, for the past two decades or so, we've been completely consumed with terrorism from violent Islamist elements, from Al-Qaeda or ISIS, or indeed the persons they've been able to inspire to carry out lone actor attacks in the United States. And we often forget that there's a very long history of terrorism in the United States. I mean, going back to the mid-19th century with the Ku Klux Klan, Klan, of course, anti-immigrant violence, which was quite common in the United States against the Irish, the Chinese, Jewish immigrants throughout the latter part of the 19th century, the revival of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. And then from the 1960s to the mid-1980s, let's say, we had considerable instances of both left and right-wing terrorism, probably at that period more left-wing terrorism from the Weather Underground, for example. But we did see in the 1980s the rise of a variety of far-right violent extremist organizations. What we're seeing now is just a resurfacing of this at particularly contentious times. I mean, certainly there's been what I would call left-wing terrorism. For example, in June 2017, an individual who professed to be a supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders attacked a congressional baseball practice that Republican members of Congress were engaged in Alexandria, seriously wounded six individuals, including the House Minority Whip, Steve Scalise. I already described that incident with Mr. Von Spronson when he attacked an ICE facility. But overwhelmingly, the violence we're seeing in recent years is coming from the extreme far-right neo-Nazis, white supremacists, white nativists, and so on. According to the Anti-Defamation League, which is a non-governmental group that tracks this, I mean, bear in mind, there's no domestic terrorism statute in U.S. law. So the FBI really doesn't collect statistics on what we call domestic terrorism. So people have proposed legislation that would fix that. So we have to go rely on authoritative non-governmental sources. So according to the ADL, between 2009 and 2019, 76% of all the killings of individuals, 435 deaths in the United States from quote-unquote domestic terrorism, were perpetrated by the violent far-right. Left-wing terrorists accounted for only 3%. 20% were those individuals I just spoke of who were inspired or motivated by either Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So what we see over the past decade, there has been an upsurge of terrorism from violent right extremist elements. And in 2019, it was even more starkly depicted, I would say. That year, there were 42 deaths. 81% were from white supremacists, but 5% more were from anti-government extremists. This is how the Anti-Defamation League categorizes them. And an additional 5% were by other violent far-right groups. So that's to say about 90% of all the terrorist incidents that claim someone's life in the United States in 2019 can be laid at violent far-right extremists. And
are these
groups
mainly lone wolf individual attacks? Somebody's radicalized or angry or has mental issues and are striking? Or are we seeing coordinated attacks tied to some particular organization?
Both. I would say that for all terrorists everywhere, ISIS has had an enormously powerful influence in that the lone wolf or the lone actor, not even using an assault weapon, let's say. And we've seen those, of course, at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at a synagogue in Poway, California, at the Walmart store in El Paso last August. I mean, we've seen people use assault weapons, but we also see individuals using vehicles, ramming attacks. There was just one last week in Richmond, Virginia, by a local Ku Klux Klan leader against a Black Lives Matter demonstrations. So much like ISIS has resorted to people using weapons, but also using just ordinary day-to-day implements that we use, like cars, to ram people, we've seen that on the violent far right. And of course, the killing of Heather Heyer at Charlottesville in August 2017 is another example. But just in the past few months, we've seen an individual who was killed in a shootout with the FBI in Missouri, who was planning to bomb a hospital in Kansas City, treating COVID-19 patients, claiming that this was the COVID-19 pandemic was all a conspiracy by the United States government to erode our civil rights. In April, an individual planted a firebomb at a Jewish assisted living facility in Massachusetts. So there we have individuals, but then back in January, at the end of the month, there had been a big pro-Second Amendment demonstration planned in Richmond, Virginia, and a group, a very shadowy far-right violent group called The Base, whose leader is situated in St. Petersburg, who's an American citizen.
St. Petersburg, as in Russia.
As in Russia, yes.
Okay, that's right. Make sure.
As in Russia. Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to Florida.
As opposed to Florida. These individuals were arrested in Baltimore, three of them planning an attack on this gun rally. Again, this, as they call it, the accelerationist philosophy. In other words, piggybacking on a contentious issue that has brought individuals exercising their civil rights to protest and demonstrate and state their views on the streets, but then seeking to use violence as a catalyst to create disorder and those three were arrested by the FBI at the end of January. So that they were part of an organized group.
Bruce, are we seeing any evidence that foreign powers are playing in these waters to sow division in the United States, to create trouble? Or is this merely individuals acting without any sort of encouragement or support from state actors?
No, the foreign influence is clearly playing a role, much as it had, for instance, in the 2016 presidential election, where you have troll farms and bots that are sometimes assuming Antifa underscore US, for example, sending out messages encouraging violence. And it turned out that that was not foreign. That was actually a domestic extreme right group. But those types of troll farms and bots are also churning the waters. I think the authorities now are trying to investigate the pedigree, but certainly there's been indications and hints that others, not just Russia either, but Russia, China, Iran, for example, are pumping out information to both muddy the waters and stir the pot and undermine the United States all the more.
So as social media and the ability to communicate widely, but also anonymously, sort of fundamentally changed the nature of the threat posed by domestic terrorists?
Absolutely. 10 years ago, I mean, these would have been lone individuals sitting in a basement somewhere trying to connect, perhaps over the internet, and succeeding in doing so, but in a rather piecemeal and less pervasive real-time way. Today, especially encrypted social media apps enable this type of exchange of information, this type of, I mean, for want of a better term, radicalization, where you can go from being a nobody sitting on your sofa in the basement to now being an activist, and even more than an activist, a radical and even a foot soldier serving this cause, having been persuaded that violence is the only answer.
You know, we've been talking to this point about terrorism that is explicitly linked to a political agenda, whether in left or right. But you've written recently about a different kind of terrorism that we may face, so-called incel terrorism. Can you talk us a little bit about that?
What drew me to incel terrorism, and this is a very small subset of, again, a very amorphous movement, incels, involuntary celibates, mostly males, but not exclusively, who over the past 6 years or so have perpetrated only a handful, fewer than a dozen violent acts, but on average, they've killed 8 or 9 people, which is not inconsequential and approaches a school shooting level. And what first drew me to the study of this phenomenon was because the violent extreme fringe of the incel that are advocating violence, to my mind, conformed exactly to what we've been talking about, to Antifa or the Black Bloc or anarchists or to the Boogaloo or violent far-right extremists. In other words, no organization, no leader, no hierarchy, but a steady stream of encouragement, incitement over social media, goading people to violence. And what we've seen most recently, for instance, in Canada, there was an attack on another in the United Kingdom just in the past few months, is individuals carrying out acts of violence, in many cases, but not in all cases, against women who they see as an enemy to exact revenge because they had been somehow ignored or dismissed by women, but they killed males as well. They basically engage in violence as almost a cathartic act and then cite this ideology such as it is, or cite this common agreement that they're forever going to be excluded and their only option is to use violence to demonstrate what they see as this horrible inequity in society that these young men cannot find sexual partners.
So is this an agendaless movement? I mean, is it just rage that is being unleashed because the internet allows people who are similarly enraged and feel disenchanted to act? I mean, how do you think about this?
Well, again, I think it's in many respects a product of social media, is that these would be isolated individuals who would find it difficult to connect with like-minded peers, who then create basically this endless echo chamber that complaints, and the complaints give rise to wanting to take action, and the action is justified as violence, striking out at society. I mean, in many respects, this isn't new. This is exactly what Frantz Fanon, the psychiatrist who wrote one of the most important texts, I think, on terrorism generally, The Wretched of the Earth, which was about how a person of color and a Muslim in Algeria felt that violence was striking a self-satisfying blow against an oppressor and against a system that was French colonialism that was inherently subjugating. And this sort of mentality gains increased currency and gathers a momentum that everything we've talked about today, it plays into. It's the catharsis of violence, that all of a sudden your own frustrations are being given believe in an altruistic veneer, that you can strike out and that you can also be a vanguard. You can be a champion of whomever you consider your like-minded peers or your constituency to be. And unfortunately, we see that it involves either in a place like the United States where you can get firearms, or you don't have to resort to firearms. Machetes, knives, or even vehicles have been used to attack people and in some cases to kill.
So how should government go about trying to diffuse, prevent, mitigate these sort of attacks? I mean, you talked earlier that the nature of these more amorphous groups creates challenges for the government because of the variety of techniques we developed in the wake of September 11th to track money and things like that don't actually apply here. And you have sort of this amorphous grouping, you know, communications through encrypted apps. And, you know, we can say that, you know, right now, none of these attacks has produced death on the scale we saw September 11th. But then again, before September 11th, no one anticipated that a terrorist group would be able to produce that much wreckage for essentially relatively small investment, if I can put it in those terms. So I don't want to downplay what these groups may be capable of, but how does a government intelligently think about how to deal with this challenge?
I think it's more challenging now than ever because, of course, we all want to believe that we've turned a corner in the war on terrorism. I mean, we've been told repeatedly from the president and others that Al-Qaeda is defeated. Secretary of State very recently issued a statement to that effect, that the threat from ISIS is receded. And there is very much an inclination to say that we've won the war on terror and to go back to business as usual. I think what the COVID-19 pandemic and now the tragic killing of George Floyd are showing us is that business as usual, just it's going to take some time to ever get back to. And unfortunately, there are elements in our society and societies elsewhere that are committed to deepening the divisions and polarization that already exists. So I think first and foremost, that law enforcement and intelligence have to understand that actually the way we've studied terrorism for several decades now is becoming outmoded. We can't just look at organizations and groups and a hierarchical leadership because they don't exist. And that's what we've been so effective in neutralizing. So we have to understand the dynamics of these new movements and indeed the role that social media plays. I think that a lot of this entails a shift in our intelligence capabilities. Until recently, the National Counterterrorism Center, the NCTC, was focused almost exclusively on external threats. It is now turning very quietly to studying more internal ones, not least because the distinction between domestic and international terrorism is eroding. I talked earlier about this group, The Base, that's active in the United States, but has an American citizen who its leader based in St. Petersburg, Russia. And this is not at all uncommon. Whichever the groups are, I mean, Antifa is also an international movement as well. I mean, none of this is domestic. Incels as well is becoming more international. So I think it's understanding the dynamics, understanding the role of social media in this. But also it gets down to some of the issues that are being discussed now with respect to how we channel the money for law enforcement and for securing society. I mean, in some cases, there are interventions where that mental health professionals can provide in some instances and where education would be very important. But I think the key is to realize that, you know, terrorism is a perennial threat. It's one that constantly evolves and changes and presents even new adversaries that we hadn't thought of just a few years ago, and why we can't relax our vigilance and why those responsible for protecting us, whether in the intelligence community or in law enforcement, have to have access to the best information, have to be knowledgeable of this range of threats. And in fact, their differences in how much more challenging they are when there isn't a hierarchy to target, or there isn't a financial flow, or there isn't a leader to take down.
So I know you have a lot of conversations, Bruce, with people who work on terrorism issues in the U.S. government. When you make this case to them that they have got to think about things differently, what do you hear back from them?
I would say before the Tree of Life synagogue tragedy in Pittsburgh in 2018, this was pretty much off the map. Although that said, exactly 3 weeks before, the White House and the National Security Council had issued their latest iteration of the National Strategy for Counterterrorism, which very commendably was ahead of the curve. I mean, they pointed not just to threats from Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Iran, but threats from violent far-right extremists, threats from violent far-left anarchists, for example, to emerging threats from groups, single issue groups, they called them, like incels. So they were already on top of this. And we've seen much more of a shift over the past 2 years. And that shift is certainly, I would argue, being accelerated in the past year, given the series of events in California and Texas in particular, but also as a result, I think, of a lot of the upheaval that we've seen in recent weeks.
How do you reach beyond the federal government to police forces around the country? I mean, the remarkable thing about the United States is we not only have a lot of police, we have a lot of police forces. You know, this is a country of federalism. So you have federal authorities, you have state authorities, mm-hmm. local authorities. And obviously in this decentralized movement, I would imagine if you want to succeed in stopping an attack, you're going to want people at the city and town level being aware of these things. But I would imagine it's very hard to get that message out to them.
Well, that's certainly true. I think, as I said, it's been changing as the violence has risen. But I think people in the last few weeks have come to understand that terrorism doesn't occur in a vacuum. Terrorism feeds off of and deliberately tries to exploit or opportunistically manipulate deep fissures, deep divisions within society, and to further that polarization. And they see how groups are seizing upon the COVID-19 pandemic, the George Floyd killing for their own purposes and to drive their own agendas. So that's why I said a moment ago, I think that that in and of itself is resulting in a huge change because we're realizing that all terrorism, in essence, is local. I would argue that in many respects, many local law enforcement and certainly the FBI have been on top of these trends over the past few years, but it's been isolated in pockets where they've arisen. It's become almost like the COVID-19 pandemic. Until it affects me, I'm not going to pay much attention. And then, of course, all that changed in March. I think there's going to be a similar change now because police forces will understand that these are universal movements. They're not confined to any one part of the country. For instance, the guys I mentioned earlier arrested from the base were not stereotypically in the Deep South or in the rural parts of the Rocky Mountains. I mean, they were in Baltimore. So, I mean, this suggests that it's something that isn't confined to any one part of the country and that it's as much of a challenge as the pandemic and as actual health issues are. So I think that there's now a greater awareness, not least because they see how very local First Amendment demonstrations or protests or vigils can be, or at least that these more militant extremist groups are definitely attempting to hijack them. And therefore, police have to be more aware of all the dimensions of this threat and of the modus operandi, because they can see that something that's just on the local courthouse steps of a small town can be hijacked or manipulated or exploited by other elements.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Bruce Hoffman, the Shelby Cullum, and Catherine W. Davis, Senior Fellow for Counterterrorism and Homeland Security at CFR and the author of Inside Terrorism. Bruce, thank you for joining me.
You're very welcome, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.